time together. And if you want to include within that your entire day, feel free to do that. So just to start, I mean, just settling down wherever we are, trying to find a place of comfort and ease. Maybe relaxing the shoulders and the knees and the legs. And then bringing our awareness to the flow of the breath in and out of the nostrils. And if the mind wanders, we're just bringing it gently back, like we're guiding a child back to our side, just bringing it back to focus on the breath. And then following that breath all the way up and over the skull and down on the exhale into the chest and feeling it ripple out, maybe fill the room and carry on going. And from this place in our heart center, our Anahata Chakra, we're just going to make an offering of our time together this evening, or indeed our whole time together today, to be for the benefit of all beings. I'm really getting a sense of that offering. May all beings be at peace. May all beings be happy. Om Shanti, 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 peace. And the opening the eyes, maybe taking a deep breath and letting it go. So today, and it's been a while since I was here. There was obviously the retreat, and I've been away myself. I was going to talk about death in the Gita, but I've had a change of heart. There is so much more we haven't covered before we come to the topic that almost seems sort of like a conclusion, I suppose. So I wanted to talk today about sadhana, and that is our daily spiritual practice. And as we've talked about before, the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, is rich in offering practical advice, in offering guide, in being a guide for all the different types of sadhana, the different types of practices we could do. And it's designed to appeal to the layman. There's always something in the Gita that you could do depending on your mood or where you are. So, you know, we've talked about all the different types of yoga that are mentioned in for example, the Gita touches on one of the practices, or the chief practice would be service. So it'd be serving others. And also yajna, the sort of sacrifice that we just made. So in everything that we do, sort of offering it as a service to others, making our whole life and everything we do about being for the benefit of all beings. And we've been reading a bit from Ram Dass's sort of guide to the Bhagavad Gita, and he was studying with Maharaji back in the day. And I happened to be at a workshop last night with Krishna Das, who was also there with Maharaji when Ram Dass was there. And he was saying that people would come to Maharaji and say, you know, how do I find God? And Maharaji would say, serve others. And or they come and say, well, okay, but how do I get to really know God? And he'd say, feed others. So this is a beautiful practice right there that's mentioned in the Gita and by those who follow the Gita, of just service. And then we looked at Jnana Yoga, the yoga of wisdom, and the yoga of really sort of understanding and knowing self. And the practices we touched upon there were things like studying scripture, which just by virtue of opening the Gita up is what we're doing. So contemplating scripture is another. It doesn't just have to be the Gita. It can be any scripture of any religion or tradition. And another one of the practices was to become the witness. So to try and identify with the self behind the small self, and sort of practicing that during meditation. So that was another sadhana we could do. And then we looked at bhakti yoga as well, if you remember, which is the yoga of devotion. And we talked about practices like cultivating a heart of devotion and trying to keep the mind fixed upon God and moving into sort of love for God, and how do we nurture that love for God. But there are many other practices. Well, there aren't many other practices. There are some other practices mentioned in the Gita that I really didn't want us to miss. So today I thought that we would look at those. There are three of them that we're going to talk about that we could incorporate in our sadhana, our daily practice. And then we're going to talk about sadhana more generally. And what does it mean? And some of the traps perhaps that we walk into in our own daily spiritual practice. So in terms of the three practices we're going to look at today, one of them is going to be very familiar, but two might not be to you if you've not studied yoga or Hinduism at all, or Buddhism. They come up there too. Then you may not be familiar with them. So the first is something called pratyahara. I'm just going to type that in the room because sometimes it's easier to see a word than it is to hear a word. So pratyahara. It's big in the Gita. It's mentioned early on. So we know in all the texts, particularly in yoga, that mention first is of importance. So pratyahara comes up in chapter 2, straight after we've heard Arjuna just give up and lay down his bow and arrow and say he doesn't want to take part in this battle. So pratyahara means withdrawal of the senses. And it's actually one of the eight limbs of yoga. So in Ashtanga yoga, there are these eight limbs. It's also called Raja yoga that is mentioned in the Gita. It's another one of, you know, there's Karma yoga, Jnana yoga, Bhakti yoga, and Raja yoga that is really about these eight limbs. And it sits between, in the eight limbs, the worldly practices of the yamas and niyamas, which like yoga's ethics. There's asana, so your physical practice, then there's pranayama, which is breath work, and then sits pratyahara, this withdrawal of the senses. And then following pratyahara are the internal practices like concentration and meditation, and then finally samadhi, which we're going to talk about a bit later. And it's sort of the gateway between the two of the outer world and then moving inwards, and the sort of using the senses to get there. So it's kind of almost the prep work for your sadhana, and it's certainly the prep work for any meditation, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And in the Gita, Krishna explains that the path away from present, of being present, that our mind takes is begins with being drawn away by the senses. So this practice of withdrawal of the senses allows us to sort of stay present and become one-pointed. And he says, when you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment then comes. So he talks about the sort of chain of events that follows the sense objects. So sense objects happen, and we'll talk about this in a bit more detail in a minute. And then you keep thinking about them, and then attachment comes. And then attachment breeds desire, he says, and the lust of possession turns into anger, and then anger clouds the judgment, and you can no longer learn from past mistakes, and you've lost the power to choose between what is wise and what is unwise. So this sort of, you know, disaster of events starts to occur when we just get like lost in our senses. And it's a really great practice to work with pratyahara and to contemplate and really just to watch what the mind does and to see the connection to the senses. So, for example, if this is all sound a bit esoteric, here's, you know, perhaps this will clarify it. So say you're driving in your car and a song comes on the radio and you're hearing it, and it reminds you or it's a song you heard back in high school. And listening to it, you start to feel a little nostalgic, and you start to think about, oh, you know, I really miss those days. And you get this feeling, this sensation of the good times that you had while listening to this old song. Maybe it's, Africa by Toto, I don't know. And all of a sudden you're like, you know, you're missing being youthful and being there again and all that opportunity you had, and you're sort of turning yourself into a bit of a Bruce Springsteen song. And all of a sudden, before you know it, you're kind of depressed. And then you're maybe thinking about someone to blame, I don't know. And then maybe you pull over and you go to a bar, and all of a sudden you become a country song or something. But you see, it all starts with this sense, which was hearing the song. So it's really interesting when you start to think about Pratyahara to contemplate your thought process and how that is coming from and which sense it might be coming from. So you could practice it in reverse. So maybe you're feeling it. You're thinking about a hamburger, and then you go, okay, I'm thinking about a hamburger and how I really, really want a hamburger, and I'm upset because I can't get a hamburger. And you can maybe trace it back to maybe you saw an advertisement at lunchtime about a hamburger, or maybe you smelled a burger on your way home from work. So you can begin to tap into maybe what, you know, like mentalists and hypnotists do, with the power of suggestion that comes, it's from your senses initially. So what do you do? What do you do to withdraw from the senses? How do you stop that? Now, obviously, you could just close your eyes, which is why we do that in meditation, or sit in silence. So you're beginning to shut down some of the senses, making yourself comfortable, but not too comfortable. So touch isn't really stimulated too much. But we're humans, and the yogis sort of don't want us to deny our humanity. And if you remember, the Gita is doesn't advocate you go and sit in a cave. It wants you to continue with your life. And so we can't always just get rid of all the things and sit in a sense deprivation tank or go and sit in a cave. So one way to work with Pratyahara is just to become the witness. So just noticing when that move from the senses interacting, and this is talked about in Buddhism as well, when any of the senses interact, and then watching just that, sort of trying to catch that moment where then the mind takes off. And in that moment, and with practice, this will come more quickly, just returning to the breath. So trying not to follow that pathway down the rabbit hole that begins with the senses interacting. And another practice with Pratyahara, which is more unusual, but I recommend it, particularly if you're sort of beating yourself up about your senses or trying to control your senses too much, is to instead really delve into the senses. Use the senses in a way to become present. So instead of letting the mind go, you just go deeper into the sense. So perhaps you can smell cut grass, or you can smell the sort of foliage beginning to rot in autumn, and it's a really lovely earthy smell or something. And then instead of sort of letting that go off on a tangent, but just moving into that more deeply. So what is that smell? Moving into that smell. Or if it's a sound, maybe trying to make your body become like an ear. So the whole of your body is absorbing the sound you're listening to, instead of thinking about the words or the lyrics to Toto's Africa. You're just sort of really moving into the bass notes and the drum beat or something. And the Irish philosopher and mystic and poet John O'Donohue really loves this idea of engaging in the senses to become present, and he talks about it a lot in one of his books, Anamkara. And he suggests that the senses are like the gateway between the body and the soul. So that by really engaging in the senses, you get to sort of commune between the two. So almost like what I just mentioned of where it sits in the eight limbs of yoga, it sort of sits between this outer world and the inner world, but really sort of enjoying that to become present. And in chapter 2 in Sloka 67, it talks, there's this lovely line about Pratyahara, it says, like a ship, this Krishna says this, like a ship tossed helplessly about by a gale, a mind subject to the roving senses loses all, go into the senses. And so that's just one practice, and it's not one I'm familiar with in other traditions. So I thought I didn't want to skip over that, particularly as it takes up much of a chapter in the Gita. And it's a preparation for our next practice, which is touched on in the Gita. And this is one we're probably much more familiar with, and that's meditation. But I wanted to just cover what it says about meditation. It doesn't say too much, but it does offer some guidelines of how to sort of breaks down meditation into several chunks. And so I thought I'd share that with you. The first is, and we're following these eight limbs of yoga again, is dharana. So after pratyahara, this withdrawal of the senses, is a limb called dharana, and it means concentration of the mind. Now, we tend to talk about meditation very, very broadly in the West, and sometimes we'll just say, this is meditation, but actually in yoga it's dharana, and it's things like concentrating on the breath, keeping the mind on the breath. That would be dharana, concentration, keeping your eye on a flame or a chakra, focusing on a chakra, or even sort of a mantra. And there's a little bit of discernment to be had around the mantra part, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But it really just involves trying to make the mind, as a practice, one-pointed. So just stopping the mind from following the thoughts willy-nilly and keeping it very still and in one place. So just stopping the monkey mind. Some practices that I was taught by my yoga school, which I think are really fun for doing this, is one is to keep your eye on the second hand of a clock face as it moves around. Which sounds very simple, but actually, as you keep your mind focused on the ticking and the movement of the second-hand clock, you can find by about 45 seconds, you've just lost it. Your mind has gone elsewhere and you've missed 10 seconds, probably. So it's a fun practice to try and build up how many minutes can you keep watching this second hand go round and stay sort of super focused on the movement of this hand. And another practice for dharana is to take, I don't know, we could start low, like 30 toothpicks or matches, something that all looks the same, or maybe 70 if you want to stretch yourself, and you just sort of throw them down in front of you. So they'll crisscross over each other inevitably, and some will be further away, and you count them. And you'll find that as you count them, it becomes very difficult to concentrate on those you've counted and those you haven't. And it takes quite a lot of practice. You think, oh, this is easy. There's 40 toothpicks here. Of course, I'm going to count them all. But quite often, early on in your practice, you'll find that at toothpick 20, you think, I can't remember if I've counted this one or I haven't counted this one. So they're really great practices for sort of incorporating in your daily life. Or, you know, if you've got a couple of minutes spare, oh, I'll just practice being one-pointed. Practice concentration, this dharana. And then it moves on to the seventh limb of yoga, which is dhyana, and that tends to be more aligned with meditation, like the purest form of, well, it's a form of meditation. So now we're not just bringing the mind back to the breath and trying to be one-pointed, and we're not just focusing on the finger held in front of us or the flame or the chakra. Here we're actually sort of moving into the essence of that which we're meditating on. So, for example, if you chose Om to be your focus, then maybe in dharana you're just trying to say, oh, goodness, like, oh, my mind's wandering, I'm coming back to Om. My mind's wandering, I'm coming back to Om. But when you've nailed dharana, what you'll be doing is you'll be sat there and Om. Your goal with holding Om in your mind will be moving into its essence, meditating on the essence of Om. And that could be maybe an image of God or a quality of God or the void or whatever it is you're meditating on, but really sort of moving into the essence of it. So it's a state of absorption, maybe sort of filling the cells of your body with whatever you're focusing on. So it's a more sort of organic, fluid, there's less focus that's needed. It's more of a sort of merging. And then the final limb of yoga is samadhi, and there's actually seven parts of samadhi, and those are just the deepness of your meditation. So just moving deeper and deeper into your meditation until eventually there is no one meditating on something, that you've become this one. And that's the goal of yoga, to sort of merge completely and become oneness. And in the Yoga Sutras, there are these seven stages of samadhi. So that's meditation. And as I mentioned, so the Gita talks about meditation. There's an entire chapter dedicated to it, but it doesn't sort of go much into the nitty-gritty, unlike the sutras, which talk a lot about samadhi and what that is and what you have to do. Instead, it just offers a few tips on how to commence meditating. So I thought I'd share those with you. Firstly, it just talks about the path. Sort of the chain of events from pratyahara through to samadhi, including pranayama, the breath work. So it says, by withdrawing attention from external things, that's pratyahara, and then mentally focusing back between the eyebrows, so that's dharana, you're beginning to concentrate on, in this particular case, the ajna chakra, the inner eye, the third eye, and then equalizing the in and out breaths, which is pranayama. Thus, you control the mind, the senses, and the intellect. Then aiming for nothing else but absolute and unconditional freedom. So this is your dhyana coming in now. All personal desires, fear, and anger will drop away, and you will undoubtedly experience the final liberation of samadhi. So that's kind of the course of events. So it talks, it's interesting to sort of see the comparison with the eight limbs of yoga and then these couple of verses in the Gita. And of course, it doesn't have to be exactly between the eyebrows, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Because in chapter six, it talks about how to prepare. So, sloka 11, Krishna says, to practice meditation, fix up a clean meditation place with your seat neither too high nor too low. So you're going to be just easy, not too comfortable though. Insulate the seat with a grass mat, then a deer skin, and over those, a clean cloth. Now, Swami Satchidananda here says, you know, don't go and kill a deer just for the sake of meditation. Obviously, this was written a long time ago. And the idea is just to sort of have some good insulation between the body and the ground. And that during meditation, you're trying to develop a new form of energy, which shouldn't be drawn down by the pull of the earth. And I thought this was interesting because I often begin my meditations with trying to be grounded into earth. So it's sort of a different view here. While you can be grounded, you're trying to separate yourself from that energy. He says, you know, use a clean towel or a mat, whatever works. You don't have to have a grass mat and then a clean cloth. But after the meditation, try and just roll it up and put it to a side because it absorbs the energy. Just like when you get into a bed, you'll sleep. There's this energy with the bed that has sleep embedded in it, with the meditation, indeed with the yoga mats. And people are kind of obsessed with cleaning your yoga mat. It's nice just to let, maybe not a sweaty yoga mat, but your meditation mat and your yoga mat just kind of be sort of charged with an energy. So when you get back on your mat next time, you're ready to go. And then it says, and then Krishna says, then sit and calm the mind and senses by concentrating on one thing. So we're in, excuse me. Thus, you practice yoga for self-purification. And that's the main purpose of meditation, is this purification, getting rid of the thoughts. You're purifying yourself with these thoughts just to come to sort of a blank space, a pure space. And then he talks about the physical position that we hold in meditation. So he says, keep the body, the head and neck erect without looking about, and the gaze instead towards the tip of the nose. And Swami Satchidananda said, you know, it's not that you need to gaze on your nose and stress your eyes. It's more about just lowering the lids of your eyes and becoming soft with your focus and very steady. And also the spine erect is, it stops you falling asleep for one, but it also says to it, there's a Shushumna Nadi, it's called, which is like a meridian line. I suppose you compare it to up the spine. And then there are two other nadis, like meridian lines, called Pita and Ingala, that crisscross back and forth around the spine. And it's said that the energy sort of rises up when you meditate, and so which is why you want to have a straight back as possible and the crown lifted, so that energy goes straight up into the crown chakra and you reach enlightenment. So, and as for this sort of focusing in the middle of your head, Swami Satchidananda says, if you touch your two ears, draw a line between them and touch the center of your forehead and the back of your head and mentally draw another line. Where those two lines cross is roughly where the pituitary and the pineal glands are. And they're like your psychic glands. There's just like your third eye is deep in there. Like the sort of the seat of the brow chakra. Some people think it's in the middle of the forehead, but he's just clarifying, no, it's actually sort of deep inside the skull. But really, wherever you want to focus, and if you want to focus on the crown chakra, that's absolutely fine. And sit thus in yoga meditation, serene and fearless, says Krishna, and firm in the vow of brahmacharya, which is self-control. With the mind calm, think of me and only me. And this is samadhi, where we're thinking of just the divine and our goal to reach the divine. So another practice that we can use, and as I mentioned, this is Raja Yoga. And Krishna says, by steadily and continuously practicing yoga in this way, the yogi wins over his mind and realizes that peace is his very nature. Thus, in turn, naturally leads to nirvana, which is quite an inspiration. and also in this chapter, it has this lovely phrase or this lovely slogan. It says, the well-trained mind of a yogi is as steady as a flame in a windless place, which I love, as steady as a flame in a windless place. So for many of us, meditation is part of our daily sadhana. It's something that we do anyway, or certainly think we should be doing as part of our daily spiritual practice. Although it's mentioned in the Gita, you know, as I mentioned, there are many other paths that are mentioned too. So it's not that meditation has to be part of your spiritual practice, that you'll never reach your goal without meditation. But it's certainly mentioned enough in a chapter to encourage people to sit down and at least be silent. And again, Swami Satchidananda points out here, it's about quality, not quantity, as we know. It's not about just sitting down for an hour and doing this, even if it's just 10 minutes of a day, but your whole heart is there and you're fully absorbed in it. That's very, very powerful. And the third, excuse me, I'm so thirsty because the heating has kicked on and it's incredibly dry in my apartment. So the third practice that is talked about in the Gita, and it's probably one of my favorites, and that is mantra and japa. And Krishna says, when he's talking about himself as God and all the wonderful things that he's trying to compare himself to explain to Arjuna, you know, what is God? He says, of all the words, I am Om. And of all sacrificial offerings, I am japa. So here he's basically saying, of all the sacrificial offerings that you could do, of all the rituals you could do, japa, which is repetition of a mantra, is the best that you could do. And if you're going to chant anything at all, any mantra at all, of all of them, Om is the one that you want to chant. So what does this mean? And what is a mantra? And what, I sort of looked for some explanations of what it is. And I liked this one. It says man, sort of translates in Sanskrit as man or mind, and tra as opening or liberation. So mantra is that which leads to blossoming or liberation of the mind and heart. Ram Dass actually says mantra means mind protecting. So he talks about, and we'll talk about this a bit later, about the mantra being a way to focus the mind. A about to keep God inside the mind and everything else out, sort of protecting the mind from all the nonsense. And there are so many different mantras. There are seed mantras, which are said to have like a vibrational quality. Like Om, for example, is supposed to be like the primordial sound of the universe being created. And when we chant Om, we're connecting to that sound, connecting to the very source of creation. Each of the chakras has a seed mantra that if you chant them, then you start to make the chakra spin and vibrate. And this is called Bija mantras. And then there are other mantras like Om Namah Shivaya is one that you may be familiar with. And that sort of calls to Shiva. And it has within it the essence, it's also like a seed mantra, it has within it the essence of destruction. So when we chant Om Namah Shivaya, we're saying we're open to destruction, we're open to be destroyed, we're open to become anew. And there are very long mantras, like the Gayatri, well, it's not very long, but there are longer mantras, I suppose, like the Gayatri mantra, which is chanted by millions and millions of people all over India today. And that's like a prayer to God as the sun. As the divine. It's a very beautiful three-part prayer and mantra. And there is a lovely rendition by Deva Primal of the Gayatri mantra. There's the Hanuman Chalisa, which is really long. I think it's about 35, 40 slokas or something. It takes about 10 to 12 minutes, the Hanuman Chalisa. And it talks about many of the things that happened in Hanuman's life. It's almost like a story, but it's said that in every word there is an essence and like a vibration. So when you chant the Chalisa, you're sort of bringing in the grace of Hanuman and connecting to Ram. And it's really, really powerful. If you ever get the chance to do the Hanuman Chalisa, Krishna Das has whole CDs dedicated to the Hanuman Chalisa and teaching people the Hanuman Chalisa. It's well worth doing. If you're familiar with Kundalini Yoga, I mean, oh my God, there are so many mantras in Kundalini Yoga that you chant 40 days on end to have a certain goal. And so there are mantras for everything. And Ram Dass in his book mentions that, you know, there are mantras for going to the bathroom that he's been taught, depending on whatever you need to do in the bathroom is a mantra for you. There's mantras for making money. There's mantras for different parts of the body. There's mantras for health. There are so many. And some, as I say, have this very special vibrational quality. And others are just sort of tuning in to essence. In the Gita, there are two mantras in particular that I mentioned. One is Om, that is mentioned several times, as I said, and one of them is like a ball that you could chant. You should chant Om. And when we come to talk about death, it's said that if you're on your moment of death, you could chant Om, then you'll go straight to enlightenment. You won't have to come back and be reincarnated. So Om is mentioned. And then also Om Tat Sat is the other one mentioned. Let's have a look here. So it says in chapter 17, the three words that represent the absolute, that represent God, are Om Tat Sat. And Om is sort of to be chanted when it says undertaking spiritual disciplines. And then those who seek enlightenment should also repeat the word tat to ensure that their undertaking will have no taint of personal reward seeking. And then sat means reality, that which is, and indicates goodness. And so Krishna says, therefore use it, Arjuna. Therefore its use, Arjuna, blesses an undertaking with auspiciousness. So in fact, most of the chapters end with the words Om Tat Sat. Swami Satchidananda says it means basically that is the truth. So Om means that is the truth, Tat means that, Sat means truth, and Om, that's the truth. So it's really just by chanting it, we're chanting on truth. Many different uses for all of the mantras. Some are to gain things. Others are to just still the mind and to focus the mind. A japa is the repetition of mantra. So it's just, constant repetition. So always keeping your mind in that place. So I guess if japa is like the best of all offerings and om is the best of all mantras, then repetition of the word om might be like the king of kings when it comes to japa mantras. So I thought I'd just read what Ram Dass has to say about mantras, because I thought it was really beautiful. And they can be confusing. Like, what exactly are they? Do they have this special power or not? And he says, mantras can be used as a way of stilling thought as well as focusing thought. So if you imagine the mind as being like an ocean with waves of thought surging along on it, waves going in all directions because of the cross currents of the tides and the winds, in that ocean, a mantra sets up a single wave pattern that gradually overrides all the others. So in amongst all the turbulence and the choppiness of the waters of the mind, the gradual repetition of a mantra becomes the new direction of the waves. So it gathers all the waves with it. So it overrides them all until the mantra is the only thought form left, says Ram Dass. And then there's just this one continuous wave going through your mind, going and going. So even though you may be driving, really you're just sort of repeating in your mind, Rama, 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 Rama. And sometimes I notice that if I sing a lot of mantras and repetitive mantras like japas, I'll wake up in the night and it will just be running in my head like a program, and I'm pretty sure it's running through my dreams. And I wake up in the morning and there it is again. It's just constantly running in the background. He goes on to say that mantras aren't magic spells. Power mantras are just sounds. And unless you're the kind of person who has this one-pointedness of mind and the particular personality characteristics that make those power mantras work, they're not going to work for you. But what it does, a mantra, is it concentrates the already existing stuff within you. So it brings it into focus. He says it's like a magnifying glass with the sun. And the magnifying glass doesn't have any heat in and of itself, but it takes the sunlight and focuses it and makes it one-pointed, and the mantra becomes like that magnifying glass for your consciousness. So that sounds a bit confusing, but the way I look at mantra is that it sort of connects me to an essence. And that essence is already inside me, but I may not be fully embodying it or fully connected to it. So, for example, when I feel like I'm ready for a big change in my life or there's something I need to shift, I'll chant Om Namah Shivaya over and over again. Not because, you know, I'm sort of believe Om Namah Shivaya is going to sort of change me. That's not really my goal, although I do have that belief. It's more like I'm trying to connect to that part of me that is sort of allowing that to shift, because Shiva is like the destroyer. So I'm connecting to the Shiva within me, that destructive part inside of me that can allow for new beginnings. Similarly, if I was to sing the Hanuman Chalisa, then I sort of see it as connecting to the essence of Hanuman inside me. And Hanuman represents like the flow of grace. So connecting to the grace and the love that Hanuman has. Similarly, Krishna, if you're singing Hare Krishna, some repetition of Rama Krishna, Hare Krishna. For me, Krishna represents kindness, a real sort of compassionate kindness. So I'm sort of searching inside myself and trying to connect to that part of myself. And I always think about mantras like I think about my puja table. So puja tables, like you know, maybe a little table you have with like a shrine area, I suppose. So maybe on my shrine at the moment, it's a bit sparse, but I've got Kuan Yin and, you know, a little Buddha and Hanuman. Ramana Maharshi's picture is missing at the moment, but it's normally there. You know, some people say you're not, that these aren't symbols, what you have on your puja table. They're actually, you know, this is Kuan Yin. I'm sat here with Kuan Yin as I'm meditating and she's in front of me. I'm with Kuan Yin. And I normally have a little cross of Jesus as well. So Jesus is there in the room with me. But also the way I look at it, and I look at my mantras the same way, is that they are the essence. So some people have you know, mentioned to me that maybe it's not good to have all these different elements on one puja table because it can be diluted or confusing and I should be one-pointed on God. But the way I look at it, and everyone's very different, is that they are all qualities of God that I hope to tap into within myself. So, you know, Jesus and Kuan Yin, for example, for me are compassion. As I mentioned, Hanuman is the flow of grace. Ramana Maharshi, I see as love. And then a few other things, like I've got rose crystals and they to me mean motherly love. And I have some darker crystals that mean like love of the earth. Like mantras, it's a way of connecting. So when we're thinking about sadhana, and this is what I'm talking about, it really, I think mantra and having a puja table are something very beautiful to include if it calls to you, particularly if you're a devotional type, because they can focus the mind on a quality within you that is a quality of the divine. And by constant repetition or a connection to, you know, in the case of a puja table, that object in front of you, you can begin to move into and open to that very essence itself. And then Ram Dass talks about this, an experience he has of chanting a mantra, just to give you some idea of the power. So he says, I experienced once with a mantra. I'd done it for a couple of days, and when I stopped, it suddenly sounded like I was surrounded by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Thousands of voices in every direction going back over time, all doing the mantra, and I completely freaked. I thought somebody was putting me on, that they had the radio going in the next room or something. I couldn't believe that I had tuned into the other space where mantra is always being chanted. And this is what I find particularly special about mantra, is that in some way you are connecting to that place inside yourself that's the essence, but also you're tuning into a sort of collective repetition of the mantra, I suppose. So I just wanted to talk about, you know, sort of preparing to recite a mantra. And one way that I do it is sort of as if you're preparing for meditation. So all those usual rituals you go through, or that, you know, to get yourself in a place, you know, maybe relaxing the body and then coming to the breath. And then it's sort of getting your mind in a real big place of expansion and understanding or setting an intention that you're going to connect with those who have chanted that mantra before and who will chant it again. So you're connecting to like a whole sea of people who've ever chanted this mantra. And then you chant it normally out loud so you can connect to the sound in your voice. So you can sort of bring the mantra into your throat and body. And then you sort of drop to a whisper, and then you just silently repeat the mantra in your head. And what that does is it allows you to like boom it out, like you're seeing opera into space or something. Or you can sort of whisper it very quietly in your head, and you can play with different tones. You don't have to worry about the breath. So you can make a mantra last like 5 minutes without having to take a breath because you're chanting it in your head. And while you're doing that, the aim is to sort of create, say, make your body into an ear or a shell so that you fill your entire shell with the sound of this mantra, as if you're filling every cell right down to your toes and the tips of your finger with the mantra. And then you remain quiet and you listen for the echo. And what you're really doing there is you're hearing the feeling of the mantra. Because, right, it's, you know, before the word, there was just like essence. And you're sort of tuning right back before there was even form into just essence. And so it's a really, really beautiful practice to include in the sadhana, this chanting of the mantra. And particularly if you're chanting the names of God, which is, you know, what you would do in a kirtan, more like a call and response, or even without a kirtan, just chanting Rama, 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 or Krishna, Krishna. But I like a call and response as well, like Krishna Das does. In fact, in one of the songs I was listening to today, he mentions that really the name of God, all I need is your name, which I think is such a beautiful thing. And to think about that, all we need is a name of God, and then we chant it, and through that we can connect with God. So it's a really beautiful practice, and I say it's one of my favorite. And one of the other reasons I like it is because, you know, when you chant Om, your mind can't really come into play, because if you're thinking about primordial sound, I mean, your mind's got nowhere to go with that. So it kind of nixes it, and then you just sort of just flow. Your body sort of flows into the sound itself. And the same with the Sanskrit names of God. If I was to chant the word God, 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 God over again, it might bring up some issues for me, and what is God? But when I sort of just connect to the word Rama or Krishna, then it's a bit easier for me just to fall into it. Or Tara, perhaps Tara is another one I sometimes chant. So there are so many paths we can take, and so many practices we can do. And it's not just obviously the ones that were mentioned in the Gita. There are practices from all different traditions. And in chapter 4 of the Gita, sloka 11, Krishna says this, you know, he says, however people sincerely call on me, then I come to them and fulfill their heart's desires, and they use many paths to reach me. So as long as you're sincere in whatever your practices are during your sadhana, then it doesn't matter what practice you choose. You just choose the one that's more aligned with your heart. And we're going to talk about that now. So sadhana, our daily practice. One of the struggles that many people have with the sadhana is they say, you know, I've had this sadhana for years and years and years, and I just don't seem to be making any progress. Or they're dissatisfied with the sadhana, or they find it hard, or they've hit a wall. And when I was thinking about this today and yesterday, what occurred to me was that it's very hard to keep the mind out of our sadhana, of our spiritual practice. Because often when we're thinking about creating a sadhana, and already like you can hear the mind involved in that statement, it's with a goal, or we're planning the practice. So saying, right, I feel like I should have a sadhana. I feel like I should have a practice. So what I'm going to do is, you know, I've probably got like 10 minutes in the morning, or maybe an hour, and I think I should meditate. So I'll put that in there. And I like the sound of this mantra chanting, and maybe I'll do a bit of this and that, and, you know, service. I'm going to throw some of that in. So already you can see that the mind is starting to be involved, and we're thinking about what results are we going to get, and we're thinking about the result. Or we already have a sadhana practice, you know, a daily practice, and we're thinking, I'm not getting results, or I am getting results, and this is great. And meditation in particular is one that we sort of fall into this trap regularly. We find it hard, or we don't see any change being made. We don't feel like we're moving deeper into meditation. Some days we sit down and we just feel like we're back to square one. The thoughts are racing and we're not getting anywhere. And prayers is another one that often we sort of, I've prayed and prayed and prayed, and I don't seem to be getting the answers I want, or I don't feel like God's talking to me. It can sort of deter us sometimes. So one of the nice things about a body practice as part of your sadhana, like a Tai Chi or some sort of movement, or your Hatha yoga, like practicing asana, is that you tend to see some tangible results, especially with yoga. You know, you'll notice your flexibility slowly, slowly over time improving. Or Tai Chi, maybe you'll notice an improvement in the fluidity of your moves. So sometimes it's very nice in, as I say, in your sadhana to include some sort of body practice if you're struggling with things like meditation to see results that way. And then you can just sort of take your mind out of your meditation. You know, you're like, okay, I can see that I am getting results of the sadhana, so I'm just going to stick to meditation and just trust that it's going to work for me. And then there are subtle ways that the mind creeps in. For example, in karma yoga, when our practice is serving others, we can, without knowing it, sort of place value on our service, which is just sort of typical, really, when you look at things like TripAdvisor or tipping. We have turned service into something that we judge. You know, the service wasn't good enough, and the service was subpar, or it was brilliant, and this person deserves 25% for the service, and this person deserves only 10% tip. So you can see that service, sort of subtly, we might be judging it, deciding what's more noble, what isn't, as we're making offering. So there's all sorts of sort of hidden traps, as I say, of the mind coming into sadhana. And really, it's just sort of trying to be aware of it. I'm trying to be aware of when we're not just sort of purely expressing ourselves and tuning into God or reaching out for the divine, and when we're actually sort of using things for our benefit or that we're judging. So, of course, we have to think about sadhana to start with. That's what we do. Better to start somewhere and bring the mind in and make a plan than to not make a plan at all. But often what we also do is, with our sadhana daily practice, is we think of it as being a part of the day and not the whole of the day. And we sort of, you know, box it into a certain area. So, for example, I know that I've been prone to be like, you know, I'm blessing things, I'm trying to make yajnas everywhere, and even, you know, when I'm working, I'm thinking I'm doing this for the benefit of others, and all of a sudden I get very busy, and then I think, oh shit, I haven't got time for this. I'll have to just put the sadhana aside for a minute and just focus on what I'm doing for my boss. So you can see that, you know, it's the sadhana is one part of my day, and then the rest is nothing to do with my spiritual daily practice. And Krishna Das told this really cute story last night of how when he was with Maharaji, there was an old woman who lived in a village, and she got a bus to the ashram, I think it's Kanchi, the temple, to come see Maharaji. And he said she arrived and she was crying and really highly emotional. And she was like, Maharaji, Maharaji, Baba, tell me how I can reach God. Tell me how I can reach God. And she was flapping around. And he said that Maharaji just sort of looked at her and sort of flapped his hand and said, oh, later, Ma, later, later. And so at the end of the day, the woman's, you know, it's almost time for her bus. She's going to go back and get on her bus, and she's sort of preparing herself. She's going back to her family down in the village to probably cook them a meal or something. And so she's preparing herself, and Maharaji comes up to her and says, Ma, okay, come over, and I'm now going to tell you about how to reach God. And she says, no, not now, Baba, not now. I've got to get home and get on the bus. So we have this sort of schizophrenic way sometimes that we view our spiritual practice, that it fits into this box that we have to do at certain times or certain practices. And Kelly's saying she relates. And then instead of just sort of viewing it as something we do all the time, that our whole life is sadhana. And some of that has to do with just the way our mind works. And there's almost a forcefulness that we approach our sadhana. This is another one of the traps. And the Gita warns against this. I mean, it says that extreme practices are for fools, and that really you want to become very sort of easy and gentle with any of your practices that you do in serving others or in your meditation or things that you eat for your practice. And even the story of the Buddha, you know, he did all these sort of austerities, and in the end what sort of called him to the Bodhi tree was this connection he had, this memory he had of being a young boy and just feeling like a real sense of well-being, just sat under a tree watching his father and realizing that this ease is our natural state, that it's there And we can just sort of tap into that. So, of course, we don't actually have to do any kind of practice. If we were fortunate enough just to soften into this ease and sort of surrender and be present, then, of course, there would be no spiritual practice to do. We'd realize our whole life is yoga, our whole life is our connection with the divine. But if we're not there, then obviously sadhana helps. And so just to finish, I wanted to read Sadhguru is asked the question about what is sadhana. So I just wanted to share what he said. And he says, it doesn't matter how many years of sadhana you do, you will not get anywhere. Which is helpful because then you can start worrying about all the different practices you're doing and just pick something that brings you joy. So you know, for me, I really feel connected to God if I just sing mantras. Meditation I find a bit harder, although I do enjoy it, but not to get caught up on it, because it doesn't matter what you do, you're not getting anywhere. not that you might not, he says, you absolutely will not, because the idea of doing sadhana is not to go somewhere. The idea of doing sadhana is to come to a state where you can simply be here, to understand and know that what is here is everywhere. What is not here is nowhere. Getting beyond the need to go somewhere, that is sadhana, because in fact, there is nowhere to go. There is only here and there is only now, and the rest is all in your head. Sadhana is to bring you to a state where at least for some period of a time in the day, just sitting is good enough. If you live, you are here and now. If you die, you are still here and now. You cannot go anywhere. There is nowhere to go. And he says sadhana is a device. It's really just a method to bring you to a certain level of maturity where the need to go somewhere is gone. And I love this, sort of just this ease. He says it's called getting rid of the itch. So sadhana is that blessed process through which you realize this. There is nowhere for you to go. And when the need to go somewhere stops, then you know your sadhana is successful, and then you just sit. So I often think whatever it is that you do with an ease, without thinking that it is going to get you somewhere. So for me, for example, if I chant and I don't expect it to get me anywhere, I do it because I love it. And I have friends who feel the same way about meditation. They don't feel that there is a goal to be got to. They just can't imagine not sitting down and meditating. They love it. So they're not aiming to get anywhere, that their sadhana has just sort of morphed into their life. It's just something they want to do. And then, of course, that goal is really expanding that out through everything you do in the day. So everything you do, you're just doing, and your whole life becomes this offering and practice of knowing God. So, yeah, I see I'm at the top of the hour and a half. So I'll wrap up for now. It's been a pleasure, as always, and look forward to talking next week. I think we're going to look at the yamas and niyamas, although I can't be sure. So thank you so much, and I hope you all have a really blessed week, and play around with all different practices in your sadhana. See if you can do it with ease and grace. So thank you very much, and namaste.